Well, all right, I think we'll go ahead and start getting started here. Dinosaurs, dragons, and the Bible. All right, do you guys like dinosaurs? Yeah, I've been a big fan of dinosaurs since I was a kid. Do we have any dinosaur experts here? They're usually under the age of 10 and can pronounce all the names of the dinosaurs. You might know kids like that. Some of those kids are brilliant with that. Well, I like to start off with some fun, so let's go ahead and get started here. Pastor, is it biblical to say that people are basically good? Is that working all right here? Oh, we went off. Oh, boy. Yes. At sinning. Yeah, you might know people like this, right? Here's another one. In the book of Job, God told Job to behold behemoth. It was probably also a good idea to beware behemoth. Don't want that jumping out in front of your car, do you? Especially these tiny roads out here in England, right? Here's another one. Here's my last one. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God, they were the ones who did the eating. When Jonah disobeyed God, poor Jonah, you have to feel for him, don't you? I mean, one day we're going to get to heaven and get to speak to greats like Abraham and Moses and talk about their wonderful exploits and things that occurred. And we're going to see Jonah and say, Jonah, what did that smell like anyway? Poor Jonah. Well, you know what? There's a lot of materials on dinosaurs. For example, you have technical books, you have technical articles, you got layman's books, you got kids' books. In fact, there's a lot of kids' books on dinosaurs, I've realized. Here's a few. You might recognize my first dinosaur board book or Dr. Zeus, for example. Well, there's more. This is just the start. There are a lot of kids' books on dinosaurs. Now, let me ask you, do these books give a biblical view of dinosaurs? No. In fact, it's very rare to find a children's book that actually gives a biblical view of dinosaurs. It's very rare. Usually, these books start off with something like 65 million years ago, dinosaurs this or dinosaurs that. That's usually how a lot of these books start off. And I would suggest what's happening is the world is using dinosaurs to help draw kids into a secular worldview. It drew me into it to a certain degree. I still have my first book that I got on dinosaurs. I was probably in third grade, and it opened up millions of years ago. I've still got that book. I've looked back at it. And the view in that book was all the dinosaurs starved to death because they got hot and got caught in trees. That, to me, was the gospel truth about dinosaurs as a kid growing up. So it really does influence kids. Well, the world obviously doesn't teach a biblical view of dinosaurs. What exactly does the world teach when it comes to the issue of dinosaurs? You ever stop thinking about what the world teaches about dinosaurs now? Here, I'm going to put a quote up from a secular person. Because birds are dinosaurs, did you catch that? Because birds are dinosaurs. Here's what's happened. They've taken all the birds out of the classification system, and they now lump them under dinosauria or dinosaurs. Birds are now classed as dinosaurs. That'll make you think twice at KFC, won't it? Go get yourself some Kentucky Fried Dinosaur. But of course, this philosophy, again, goes all the way back to that alleged Big Bang. And after millions of years, you get this single-celled organism that supposedly evolves further and further to where you see a dinosaur sitting on top of my head there. Actually, these are lorikeets. They're a wild bird, actually, down in Australia, and we would feed them the sugar water. They come down in droves of thousands. It was beautiful to see. But you see, this is the worldview by which hosts of people, especially on the secular side, are looking at dinosaurs. They're thinking in terms of Big Bang, evolution, millions of years, when they look at dinosaurs. Now, what we want to do is we want to do something different in here. We want to go back to the Bible. See, what does the Bible say about dinosaurs? What can we learn about dinosaurs from the pages of Scripture? Letting God be that ultimate authority and being that guidebook to look at dinosaurs. Now, to do that, we need to know what a dinosaur is. There's actually a technical definition of a dinosaur. There's a number of factors involved in it. But the two primary factors are that it is a reptilian creature that has one of two hip structures so that it raises its body up off the ground. Now, with that definition in mind, would something like a Komodo dragon or a crocodile, by definition, would they be a dinosaur? No, actually they wouldn't, because their hip structures have their legs coming out to the side and their body naturally rests on the ground. Now, what about these other two that stand upright? By definition, would they be a dinosaur? Yeah, actually they would. Now, think of that definition with something like a flying reptile, like a pteranodon or a pterodactyl. By definition, is it a dinosaur? No, actually, it wouldn't either. Neither would a plesiosaur, a water reptile. By definition, it wouldn't be classed as a dinosaur. Now, I know sometimes in a lay sense we lump these in with the dinosaurs, but by technical definition, they're not. Now, this sauropod or this baby T-Rex, yes, by definition, they would be classed as dinosaurs. Let me ask you this now. does the church, by and large, across the country, not just across the country, across the world, do they teach a biblical view of dinosaurs? What do you think? No. What do most churches teach? Nothing. That's exactly right. They don't teach anything. I grew up, I went to church, I went to youth groups, went to Sunday school all the time. We never talked about dinosaurs. Never. It was just a subject that never came up. Now, there are some Christian churches that are out there teaching a biblical view of dinosaurs, saying, hey, let's go back to the Bible to understand dinosaurs. And we want to encourage you. A lot of those churches are doing great. In fact, they're going back to the Bible to get their theology on a host of things. And we want to encourage that. Now, there are some Christians, though, that are teaching things like this. These large and a few small reptile species appear to have dominated Earth's land and sea life from 250 million to 65 million years ago. Their creation probably belongs to the fifth creation day. Here's another one. God made the reptiles, including dinosaurs, beginning about 230 million years ago. You know, here's what I suggest is happening. Many of these Christians are borrowing the world's ideas and bringing it over and mixing it with their Christianity. We're seeing that. Now, let's just step back and let's just remember, from a big picture, these two different worldviews, things like Big Bang, millions of years, and evolution, they are subsets to the religion of humanism in the same way that creation, the fall, and the flood are subsets to the religion of Christianity. Now, there's a host of different denominations, if you will, of humanism that are floating around out there. Let me just show you a handful of these. You have secularism or secular humanism. You have atheism or agnosticism. They're the ones who say you can't know if God exists. The fact is, you can't know anything ultimately in that religion either. You have new atheism, which is a very aggressive form of atheism. You have naturalism. Even when people say they're not religious, that's a fancy way of saying you're a humanist because you've already raised your own thoughts up to be greater than God and his word. There's a host of different viewpoints in here that kind of disagree with each other, but by and large, they are all humanistic worldviews. And what I suggest is a lot of Christians are borrowing some of this humanistic worldview and they're bringing it over and trying to mix their ideas about dinosaurs, the world's ideas about dinosaurs, trying to mix that with the scriptures. Now, what we need to do is go back to the Bible. Let God speak on his own terms. Let God be the framework by which we look at dinosaurs. Now, to get back to the Bible, we need to know what the Bible teaches, right? Do you guys all have the Bible memorized? Yeah, I don't either. We've had people come to the Creation Museum and recite an entire book. It is incredible to see that. But what we've done at the Ministry of Answers in Genesis is we have what we call the seven C's of history. Don't let them scare you. They're simply milestones throughout the Bible that all start with the same letter. Does your pastor preach and everything starts with the same letter sometimes? Yeah, we all do that. Now, let me explain what these seven C's are. In the beginning, God created everything in 6 days. He rested on the seventh. It was a perfect creation. We expected nothing less from a perfect God, and that's what we got, a perfect creation. And then because of man's sin, the second C in history, death and suffering came into the world. Now, after a certain amount of time, we have a flood, a global flood, a catastrophe that laid down most of those rock layers that contained fossils. Then we have the confusion at the Tower of Babel, right? I got to remember where I'm at. See, Tower of Babel, it just goes to show the effects are still in, right? You know, here we are. We can't even get our English right. We Americans do tend to butcher the Queen's English. I will be the first to admit that. Well, then we have Christ stepping into history. We see his work on the cross where the infinite Son took that infinite punishment from the infinite Father. And then we have the consummation or the fulfillment of all things, the new heavens and the new earth. This is the Bible in a nutshell right here. And at the Creation Museum, you actually walk through these first four C's and then you jump right to Christ, which is pretty powerful. What we're going to do, we're going to use some of these C's of history when we look at dinosaurs. And from time to time, we're going to see what the world says about dinosaurs, do a little bit of a compare and contrast. Now, are you guys ready to jump into these questions? You guys ready? We got three excited people here today. You guys ready? Yeah, all right. What day did God make T-Rex? Let's think about this. T-Rex is a land animal, right? See, we've seen his footprints on land. He seems very well designed to be a land creature. If we jump back to the early pages of the Bible, Genesis 1, verse 25, and God made the beasts of the earth, that includes dinosaurs here, according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. You see, this was part of day six of creation. See, God made the land animals on day six. So T-Rex is a land animal. Land animals were made on day six. So what day was T-Rex made? Day six. There you have it. You're doing good in my class. Well, what do you think that T-Rex originally ate? Originally. Think about this. I mean, look at this vicious-looking T-Rex. He's mean. I mean, look at those mean teeth and those vicious-looking claws. Not those. Those aren't that scary. Oh, I'm going to get you. What's he do with those little arms? I don't know. Do you think that was on his menu? No. What about, say this? All right, let's see what the Bible says. Jump back to Genesis 1, verse 30. Also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I've given every green herb for food. You see, dinosaurs are some of those beasts of the earth. So originally, that T-Rex was a vegetarian. You know, I've had people say, but Bodie, we found some fossilized T-Rexes. And some of those fossils have had stomach contents that were fossilized in there as well. One of the famous ones was Sue. It was one of the most complete T-Rex fossils. Inside of her stomach, we find another little juvenile T-Rex that had been eaten. Another little dinosaur had been eaten as well, a little duck-billed dinosaur, if I remember right. So at some point, they did start to eat meat. What event in Bible history changed everything to where death and suffering came into the world? Yes. When Adam and Eve sinned against God, that's exactly right. Now, whether some of the dinosaurs started to eat meat immediately, whether it's more gradual, we simply don't know. But I've had people ask another really good question. They said, okay, we saw some pretty sharp teeth on that T-Rex. We saw some pretty mean-looking claws. That T-Rex seemed pretty well designed to go out and kill and eat other things. I mean, Jurassic Park made that perfectly clear, right? Those things should be able to chase you down really well. But you know what? A lot of animals have those. These are called defense or attack structures. For example, this alligator, I took this picture of an alligator, by the way. I will never get that close again. But look at the powerful jaw and the sharp teeth on this thing. Seems pretty well designed to grab and eat something. Or the talon on an eagle. Seems so well designed to go down and grab a rabbit or a fish out of the sea. Seems pretty well designed for that. And then you see a turtle shell to help protect itself from getting eaten. And so people said if the world was very good, there was no death or suffering originally, animals weren't eating other animals, why do we see design features like this? Well, there's actually two biblical viewpoints on this. The first is that the original design was used to eat vegetarian foods, or simply used for a different purpose. For example, T-Rex, they could have a heyday in a melon patch. Yeah, they really could. Now, I've had people say, but Bodie, it's got sharp teeth. That means it's a meat eater, right? Nope. Sharp teeth mean one thing. It means it has sharp teeth. Okay? That doesn't necessarily mean it's a meat eater. In fact, there's a lot of animals that have very sharp teeth that don't necessarily eat meat. For example, cats. Cats can have a diet that's almost 100% meat, and yet we've documented some cats that refuse to eat meat. One of them here, Leah, all it would eat was spaghetti. Get that rabbit out of here. Give me my spaghetti. That's all it wanted. What about pandas? Pandas have very sharp teeth, but what do they eat? They eat bamboo. That's right. Have you guys ever seen those really vicious-looking claws on a squirrel? Yeah, what do squirrels use those claws for? Climbing trees, holding nuts, that's right. Unless you grab one. See, I grew up on a farm in Illinois. I made the mistake of grabbing a squirrel one time. Dumbest thing I've ever done. I think that squirrel won the battle. He even bit me. I couldn't get him off. Oh, he was vicious. They may be cute, but don't grab one. Well, the other viewpoint is there may have been some design changes at the fall of man. In Genesis chapter 3, things were changing. If we jump back to Genesis 3, verse 14, remember that serpent? That serpent was cursed above the other animals. It's going to crawl on its belly and eat dust all the days of its life. Most commentators think that serpent physically changed forms to be at a lower position. Whether it may have reduced limbs or lost limbs, we simply don't know. The Bible doesn't give us enough detail. But what about these other animals? You see? Was that when sharp teeth and claws and things like that came about? It's possible to help them survive in a sin-cursed and broken world. Look at the parallel things going on. To the woman, pain and sorrows in childbearing. Ladies, is this true? Yes, my wife has given birth 4 times. You ladies are incredible. But you know, this was a physical change, and it was passed along to Eve's subsequent descendants. Well, what about to the man? According to the Bible, both thorns and thistles came forth. The ground was cursed because of man to have that. So there was a physical change going on even to the vegetation. Now, consider for a moment. In a perfect world, could Adam have petted the skunks? Yeah, he could have. Makes you wonder how long it took for him to realize you don't do that anymore. Oh, look, there's a skunk. Honey, you're sleeping on the couch tonight. Leave the beehives alone, too. You see, Adam and Eve started off in a perfect world and had to adjust to a sin-cursed and broken world. We've been living in a sin-cursed and broken world for so long, it's tough for us to imagine a perfect world, isn't it? It really is. Now, I would say it would be either of these possibilities. It might even be a combination of the two, depending upon what we're looking at. But I would leave either of those options open. Well, when I talk about dinosaurs, I always get this one. Were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? What do you think? I see some yeses. I see some maybe. Let's see. What does the Bible say? Genesis 6, verse 20. Of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, that includes dinosaurs there, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. So yeah, two of each of the dinosaur kinds would have come to be on board the ark. Now, as soon as I say that, I have people say, but how'd you fit them great big huge dinosaurs on that little bathtub ark? There's two problems with this, right? First off, why would you take the great big huge dinosaurs on board Noah's Ark? Do you realize the largest dinosaur egg we've ever found is a little bit bigger than a football? Okay? So even the biggest of dinosaurs were much smaller in the past. Here's a T-Rex egg, which is that largest egg that we found of any dinosaur. So they were much smaller. It makes more sense that Noah took the smaller animals on board Noah's Ark, the juveniles. Less food, less space, less waste. He probably did this with a host of animals, not just with dinosaurs. The other problem with that image is Noah's Ark was huge. According to the Bible, Genesis 6, verses 15 through 16, and this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And it had three decks. Now, I know what you're thinking. What is that in meters? I have no idea in meters. I could tell you in feet. But let me see some cubits, though. Hold up your cubit. Fingertip to elbow is a typical cubit. Usually the king that was in charge, that was the official cubit. Now, the Bible actually lists two cubits, a shorter or a common cubit, which was about 18 inches, about a foot and a half, and then you had a longer cubit, which was a cubit and a handbreadth, which was about 20 to 21 inches. If you just use that shorter cubit, that 18-inch cubit, Noah's Ark would have had the same capacity as 522 railroad stock cars. That's a lot of space, isn't it? It really is. So I would suggest we need to start using something a little bit closer to the biblical proportions when we talk about Noah's Ark and not something like this. I mean, this is cute, but what does this tell the kids of the next generation? It tells them Noah's Ark wasn't real, doesn't it? In a subtle sense. Because there's no way something like that would possibly survive a global flood. I mean, as soon as Noah got cold, fired up the fireplace, those giraffes are toast. It's all over with for them. Well, how many kinds of dinosaurs need to be on Noah's Ark? Well, obviously it was two of each kind, but how many different kinds of dinosaurs are there? Creationists have estimated there are about 50 different kinds. Several different creationists have estimated this, and they all arrive at the same numbers. Now, a kind is different from a species. We've all heard the term species, right? We throw that term out there all the time. Now, a kind is not necessarily a species. Let me explain it like this. There's one dog kind. Noah only took two dogs on board Noah's Ark. Now, all the dogs we have today are the descendants of those two dogs. And yet, we have a multitude of species of dogs, 30-something, if I remember right. We have several wolf species, coyote species, dingoes. All the domestic dogs are all classed as the same species. But there's only one dog kind. Now, we have variations with the dog. Yes, we get dogs that are taller and shorter. Some have long snouts. Some have short snouts. Some hardly have any legs. We have pretty dogs. We have ugly dogs. But there's one dog kind. And as these dogs filter out, they're actually losing information. It's going in the opposite direction of an evolutionary worldview, just so you know. And yes, a chihuahua's lost a lot of information, poor dog. They're so ugly. In Hollywood, they put clothes on those dogs. It's crazy what they do. But you see, we see variations within that dog kind. Of course we see that. We expect those types of variations. But Noah only needed two dogs on board Noah's Ark. Same thing with our dinosaurs. We throw out species names all the time, like Triceratops or Torosaurus. These are just variations within the same ceratopsian kind of dinosaur. Noah only needed two of the ceratopsians on board Noah's Ark. Same thing with our sauropods. We have all these species names, Apatosaurus, Brachiosaur, and so on. They're just variations within the same sauropod kind of dinosaur. So if there's 50 different kinds, that's only about 100 individuals. And if you take the smaller ones, the juveniles, they easily fit on board Noah's Ark. Well, what happened to the dinosaurs during the flood that were not on Noah's Ark? Easy answer. They died. That's right. That's what the Bible said. All that was on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. I have a picture of it. Do you want to see? Yeah. Kids' books. I love them. Got to have fun with this. But yeah, a lot of these dinosaurs may have rotted and decayed. Others were rapidly buried by sediment-rich water, which seals out the oxygen, which makes them a candidate for fossilization. So in different parts of the world, we see where these dinosaurs were fleeing. We see these dinosaur trackways in Texas, for example, where just about all those footprints are all heading in the same direction, up. And if you keep following where those footprints go, you find massive dinosaur graveyards. Yeah. These dinosaurs were fleeing from the floodwater, and they couldn't go any further. They were the ones outside the ark. But do you see that tag? See, here, let me zoom up where you can see this tag better. There it is. Do you realize dinosaurs don't come with tags to say how old they are? Age is actually an interpretation. I know you guys look at me and you say, man, that guy doesn't look a day over 19. Yeah, boy, I can't get away with that, can I? You see, how do you get the age of a dinosaur bone? You see, you can't just go out there and measure it, you know, with a stick or something like that to get how long it is or what. I mean, you can do that, but trying to measure its age, how do you do it? Age is actually an interpretation. You don't date dinosaur bones. They're made out of things like limestone. So how do you get the age of a dinosaur bone? Here's how it happens. Out in the secular world, they have what's called the geologic time scale. Now, let me explain. Creationists and evolutionists, we all actually agree on something here, believe it or not. We agree on the rock layers. There really is a Cambrian rock layer, Devonian rock layer, Cretaceous rock layer. Where we disagree is the timing, okay? In the secular world, where they say it took 100 million years to lay down the Cambrian rocker, 72 million years to lay down that Cretaceous rock, they say that ended about 65 million years ago. We look at those same rock layers and think in terms of the flood of Noah's day, a massive global flood that came in and laid down these rock layers quickly. You see, notice the millions of years virtually vanishes in light of a global flood, doesn't it? It really does. But where does the age of a dinosaur bone come from? Paleontologists, they're the ones who study the bones, okay? So let's say you go to a paleontologist, you say, okay, we found a dinosaur bone. How old is it? And they say, well, we found it in this rock layer, so you go over here on our geologic time scale, and it's found in here, so it's X millions of years old. And so you say, well, how do you know that that rock layer is that old? And they say, well, that's the geologist. Go talk to the geologist, like our stratigrapher. a stratigrapher. So you go to a geologist, you say, well, how do you know this rock layer is that old? And they say, oh, it's easy. The bones we find in it are so many millions of years old. That's actually circular reasoning, but that's where that comes from. You see, people don't go out and just date those things because they're made out of things like limestone. Now, if we think about this from a biblical perspective, the flood would have occurred about 4,350 years ago. So how old were those dinosaur bones? About the age of when the flood took place. So that's the way we need to look at those sorts of things. But notice, when you have a global flood, this idea of millions of years is gone. It's just gone. That's why people cannot have millions of years and a global flood. In the secular world, if you propose the idea of a global flood, they say, no, we can't have that. Otherwise, we can't have millions of years. They're like, we cannot have a global flood on Earth. We just can't have it. Even though 70% of our globe is still covered with water, they say, we cannot have one. It's impossible. They're open to a global flood on Mars where you don't find liquid water, by the way, though. It's interesting that they do that. But millions of years just vanishes in light of a global flood. Well, let me ask you this. Does the Bible talk about any dinosaurs? What do you think? Yeah, can anybody tell me book and chapter? Yeah, Job 40. That's the one that usually pops up here. It talks about a critter called Behemoth. Do you guys use the word critter? Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, we use critter and warsh and crick. It's a different discussion, though. Well, let's read this. At Job 40, verses 15 through 19 here. Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. If you keep reading through this, this behemoth goes out into a flooding Jordan River. Has no fear. It's in amongst the reeds and the lotus trees, hardly give it shade. This is some massive creature, the first or the chief of the ways of God. But here's what I love. I love verse 17. He moves his tail like a cedar. Now, there's some Bible commentaries that footnote this behemoth. They say maybe it was an elephant or a hippo. I thought, really, an elephant or hippo that moves its tail like a cedar? You know, how does that work? Have you guys ever seen a cedar tree move? You know, if the wind is really blowing, that cedar tree might kind of kink over just a little bit more here or there. How would that possibly be an elephant or a hippo? So I went down to the Cincinnati Zoo. In the Cincinnati Zoo, they have some beautiful Asian elephants. The Asians have shorter ears. The females don't have tusks. But there's about three places around that pen that you can get to where you can see these elephants. And just about everybody congregates where the elephants are looking, and they get these nice pictures of the fronts of elephants, and they put their ears out. Well, I was on the backside. I'm back there taking pictures like, yeah, yeah. People are looking at me like, what's he doing? But I got great pictures of the backsides of elephants. You see, I wanted to see that tail moving. Now, this tail is whipping up here. It's trying to hit insects. It's just flopping around. It's not moving at all the way a cedar would move. It's moving kind of like the way a weeping willow would move. And I thought, well, what about a hippo? That thing hardly has a tail. You know, a tail that would move more like a cedar is something like this. I've got it bent around to fit on the illustration. Does that work? No. What about this one? Nope. You know, a tail that moves more like a cedar would fit a creature a little bit more akin to something like a sauropod dinosaur. And that would actually fit the context a bit more. Just to give you an idea of a brachiosaur in size comparison to an elephant or a hippo. Yeah, which one would be the first or the chief of the ways of God in that sense? Yeah, makes more sense, that brachiosaur. Well, the very next chapter talks about a critter called Leviathan. Now, this is a water creature, so by definition, it wouldn't be classed as a dinosaur. But let me read verses 18 through 21. Tell me what you think of when I get done with this. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. What does that make you think of? Yeah, like a fire-breathing dragon. Well, I've had people come and say, okay, Bodhi, this behemoth, this leviathan, they're just mythological creatures. They're not real. And I thought, really? Because the Lord is speaking to Job in Job 38 through 41. And during that time, the Lord talks about a lion. Is that real? Yeah. Raven? Yeah. Donkey, wild ox, ostrich, horse, locust, hawk, eagle, are they real? Yeah. Why would the Lord suddenly switch to mythological creatures? That doesn't make any sense. Of course they were real creatures. Oh, but Bodhi, the Lord would never make a creature that would possibly shoot out fire. Let me introduce you to a bombardier beetle, or a bombardier beetle, as some of us over there say. I'm telling you, more Tower of Babel stuff. But this bug takes two chemicals and it shoots it into a chamber in here that ignite with each other and shoot out super hot, almost flaming type vapors. I've seen a video of this thing shooting this out and it'll move its leg up to shoot in any direction. I saw it fry an ant. It was incredible to see that video. Now, I'm not a fan of bugs, but this has got to be the coolest bug on the whole planet. Spiders have been dethroned. Put this one up there. This is a fascinating creature. Now, the Bible talks about other creatures that shot fire. For example, in Isaiah, it talks about the fiery flying serpents. Did that twice here. In the books of Moses, it talks about the fiery serpents. You know what? If the Lord could do this with a bug, could he do it with a leviathan and these fiery serpents? I suggest that's not a problem for an all-powerful God. Well, why don't we find the word dinosaur in the Bible then? I mean, we see leviathan or behemoth or some of these other terms that might be used, beasts of the earth or things like that. Why don't we find the word dinosaur there? Let's think about this. Early translations of the Bible into English were in the 1500s and 1600s. You might think of Tyndale in the 1500s or the Geneva Bible. There was the Bishop's Bible, the Matthew's Bible. People were fighting over them. So they came together and they got the standardized translation, the King James, in 1611. Now, even a lot of modern translations, even today, one way or another have roots or ties going back to the King James. It's fascinating to see this. But let's use this as our example here, 1611. The word dinosaur was not even invented until the year 1841 by a man named Sir Richard Owen, a Christian guy, by the way. That is 230 years difference. So can anybody tell me why the word dinosaur isn't found in the Bible? Yeah, it wasn't invented yet. It's like trying to find the word Facebook in the Bible or Candy Crush. Yeah, some of you guys, people heard that one, I know. Yeah, but can you think of another word that may have been used that would have encompassed creatures like dinosaurs? What about the word dragon? Do you realize the word dragon is in the King James Old Testament 22 times? It's in the Geneva Bible 24 times. And just to give you an idea, it's not just one isolated book or anything like that. It's all over in the Old Testament. The translators actually translate two different words as dragon that they felt the need to translate as dragon. And it's powerful. Let's just look at a couple of these. Isaiah 27, verse 1. In that day, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent. He shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Here, Leviathan is called a dragon. In Psalm 91, verse 13, thou shalt tread upon the lion and the adder. The young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. You see, this is talking about a land dragon in this instance. So, Bodhi, are you trying to tell me dinosaurs and dragons are the are the same thing? Here's what I would suggest, and here's how I would word it. I would say all dinosaurs are dragons, but not all dragons are dinosaurs. The reason I say that is the word dragon is more of an overarching term. It would include things like flying reptiles or sea reptiles or even some of the serpentine land reptiles. Remember the word dinosaur? It was limited to a very technical definition, a particular type of reptilian creatures that have one of two hip structures. So an easy way to remember it is all dinosaurs would be dragons, but not all the dragons would necessarily be dinosaurs. Oh, but Bodie, hold on a second. I thought dragons were a myth. Who hasn't heard that? We've all heard that. Hey, kids, How to Train Your Dragon? Not real dragons. I want you to understand that. But do you realize ancient commentators, historians, people all over the world commented on dragons? As you drive all across England, you're going to find dragons in old cathedrals. You're going to find it in old mayor's chambers. You're going to find it in castles. I saw it at Windsor Castle when I was there. You can go into St. George's Chapel in there. You see dragons in a host of different places. So people clearly believed dragons were a real thing. When did people start to think dragons were a myth? When I first started to research this, I thought this would go back hundreds of years. And I thought that's going to be tough for me to pinpoint an exact time. It turns out I was totally wrong. I looked, in the late 1800s, people were still referring to dragons. They just said they were rare. In 1902, the Encyclopedia Britannica has an entry for sea dragons. They said they're real, they're just very rare. You just don't see them very often anymore. In 1910, the Encyclopedia Britannica, somebody said there were still some dragons living up in the Alps. So a man went up there, he couldn't find them, so he said, therefore, they're myth. So I guess the idea that they died out completely escaped him. You know, a lot of people went against this for a number of years. Here, the New Century Dictionary, this was published in 1927. This is reprinted in 1948. Look at this, dragon, a huge serpent or snake, now rare. You see, it's been in recent times that people said dragons were myth. This is a new idea. I mean, St. George and the Dragon. Who's not familiar here with St. George and the Dragon? I mean, it's the patron saint of England. You know, this picture was actually taken in Gamlestad, Old Town Stockholm. You see images of St. George and the Dragon in Italy. You find it all over Europe. See, St. George was probably the most famous dragon slayer. St. George, just to give you a little history to St. George, he was a Roman soldier living about 300 AD. He was a Christian, by the way. And he was in North Africa, and he came across this pagan village where this lady was tied up to a stake outside. She's like, get out of here, flee for your life, a dragon's going to come eat me. Well, let's back up and give you a little history to this. This pagan village had been terrorized by this dragon. And so they didn't know what to do, so they cried out to their gods, oh, what do we do? Oh, maybe we need to sacrifice to the dragon. So they started taking a couple of sheep out there and feeding out the dragon. Well, the dragon got bigger. And after a while, they ran out of sheep. Well, the dragon came and terrorized again. And so then they cried out to their gods, oh, what do we do? Oh, maybe we need to do human sacrifice. Maybe that'll appease the gods. So they started casting lots, rolling dice, essentially, to see who they would sacrifice. And they started sacrificing some of their citizens. One day they cast a lot, and it fell on the king's daughter. The king didn't like that. The king wanted somebody else to volunteer and take her position. But guess what? Nobody volunteered for that job. So there was the princess tied to a stake. When St. George came by, that dragon came out and he stabbed that dragon, but he didn't kill it. He dragged it back to the village and slayed it in front of everybody just to show them it was nothing but an animal. Well, they let St. George preach Christianity to him there, and the way the account goes, the entire village gave their lives to the Lord. So there you have it. You never know what your actions might lead to. So there it is. St. George rescues the princess. I'm surprised Disney hasn't gotten a hold of that one yet, right? Give it time. But you realize there are dragon legends all over the UK. They're all over the place. We find them all over Europe. We find them in the Middle East. We find them in North Africa. They're all over the place. Here in England, before the Norman Conquest, the dragon was chief among the royal ensigns in war. Even this famous Bayeux tapestry that has animals all along this huge tapestry, some of them are dragons that look very similar to dinosaurs, by the way. I was up in Leicester, and we went to Guildhall, which had been shut down for about 400 years now, the old mayor's chambers, and, you know, we saw hosts of different dragons. This is just a few of them right alongside other animals you'd readily recognize. You go to Leicester Cathedral or Bath Cathedral. I mean, you see these things all over the place. Even the flag of Wales got a dragon on it. This is an ancient flag, by the way. The old Mercian flag here in central England also had a dragon on it. The old Royal Bavarian flag in southern Germany. Look at this. They've got a dragon on it as well. We see this all over the place. If you flip over to the Orient, places like China, They were well known for their dragon legends. They used to claim that they bred dragons and used dragons to pull the chariots of the emperor. They even had cookbooks on the various parts of the dragon you use in different stews when you cook them up. In China, the dragon appeared as the national symbol and badge of the royal family. That is, if it had five toes. Nobody was allowed to have a five-toed dragon except the royal family. That was kind of their symbol. The dragon adorned the Chinese flag until the founding of the Republic of China in 1911. Here's what that flag looked like. You'll notice it's the long, slender dragon. Still, it was a legged dragon. If you've ever been to a Chinese restaurant, you might recognize their 12-year zodiac, represented by 11 real creatures, and suddenly a dragon. See, the Chinese readily viewed the dragon as being a real creature. You see this in Japan and other Asian countries. Even the flag of Bhutan and its national emblem, they put dragons on there. Now, these are more modern emblems, but they put dragons on there to represent all their history with the Druk, or the dragons, back in their past. I've been down to South America, went to Peru, and there was a host of textiles and rocks and stuff that they pulled out of the ground that had dinosaur and dragon-looking creatures on them. This was one just sitting right there in the Museum of the Nation for everyone to see. And it was neat. When we were down in Peru, our guides would point out these pumas and spiders and hummingbirds and all these different things. They said, these people, they only drew things they saw. Then we'd see these dragons, and they'd say, I don't know where those came from. So it was kind of fascinating to hear that. If you look at some old literature, Alien, in his book On the Nature of Animals, back around AD 220, he writes this. But according to accounts from Phrygia, that's where modern-day Turkey is, central part of Turkey, there are dragons in Phrygia too, and these grow to a length of 60 feet. Whew, that's pretty good. That's a lot of steak on that one, right? Feed the whole town. Pliny, writing about AD 70, he says, Africa produces elephants, but it's India that produces the largest, as well as the dragon. It's almost an afterthought. You see this in hosts of ancient literature. Well, why don't we find dinosaurs today then? I mean, they went on board Noah's Ark. They've come off of Noah's Ark. What did the world say happened to dinosaurs? Dinosaurs evolved into what? Into birds. Friends, I have no idea what T-Rex used those little arms for, but flying wasn't one of them. Down he goes. Now, it doesn't stop the world, though, because we see an awful lot of artist representations of dinosaurs with feathers on it. Do you know what we don't find? We don't find dinosaur fossils with feathers on it. We really don't. Dr. David Minton, he's one of the world's leading anatomists. He's been looking to say, okay, where are they? And he's not the only one. There are secularists, evolutionists, by the way. For example, Dr. Alan Fiducia, he's the world's leading bird expert, paleo bird expert specifically, and he's not finding them either. Dr. David Minton sums up Fiducia's research. He says, Fiducia and co-workers have presented a substantial body of evidence to support their view that there are, in fact, no known dinosaurs with feathers. They're just not finding it. Now, in today's technological age, you can hop on Google and you can search. You can search for dinosaurs with feathers on it. And I did that page after page after image, and here's what I came up with. And you come over here and you see some dinosaurs, and they got some stuff along the back side of their neck there. I don't know if you can see that very well there, just right along the back of the neck. And they say those are feathered dinosaurs. And then you come over here and you see Archaeopteryx or Microraptor or Confuciusornis, and oh, well, you know what? If you look at that little carefully, let's zoom up to Archaeopteryx. Look at that. Oh, you do see feathers. Oh, well, that means there's feathered dinosaurs, right? Nope. Those are birds. That's all they are. Dr. Alan Fiducia says this Archaeopteryx, all it is a perching bird. That's it. These are birds. That's what that is. Now, people are trying to make missing links out of these because we see dinosaur pictures all the time with feathers all over these dinosaurs. Now, just consider this for a moment. There's three ways to make a missing link. First, you take birds and you try to make them look like dinosaurs. That's what they're doing here. They're taking these birds and they're trying to do artist representations to make them look more dinosaur-y. Well, the second way is you take dinosaurs and you try to make them look like birds. You put feathers all over them, for example. You see, people would look at the back of their neck and they would say, see these little things here? They say those are proto-feathers, or the beginning of feathers, little fibers. And so they say, there you have it, right? That's feathers, right? Well, you know, a lot of reptiles actually have something along the back of their neck all the time. Those aren't feathers. So why would we think those others were? Well, people, they say, but if you look carefully, it looks fibrous, kind of. You zoom up on a couple of them and look, it looks like fibers. Now, I'm going to put a quote up here that analyzes these feathers. This is from Dr. Alan Fiducia. It's the most technical quote of the whole talk. Don't let it scare you. But here's what he says. he and his co-workers say, the fibers show a striking similarity to the structure and levels of organization of dermal collagen. The proposal that these fibers are protofeathers is dismissed. All right, let me put that in plain English. Collagen is like the glue that holds your skin and your tissues and your muscles together. Now, let's say I die and I start to rot and decay. You start to see some of those tissues. And then I get rapidly buried and I get turned into a fossil. Well, somebody comes by later and they start digging me up. They say, oh, look, we found Bodhi. Oh, Bodhi's got proto feathers. Look, he's turning into a bird. It's part of my rotting and decaying flesh. That's what you're seeing. That's what those collagen fibers are. Well, the third way to make a missing link is to fake it. Let's be honest. We're in a culture where people don't believe the Ten Commandments. Why be honest? Why tell the truth? If you can come up with a dinosaur fossil with feathers on it, you could be a millionaire. Do you think people are going to try it? Absolutely. One of the most popular fakes was published in the National Geographic back in the year 2000 by Zhu Jing. And this author was actually told 3 months in advance that we've spotted that this is a faked fossil. And they published it anyway. Well, since then, there's been a number of fakes coming out of the exact same region in China, one way or another associated with this same person. It's fascinating. And they're still wanting to publish those sort of things. In fact, people are getting better at their fakes. They really are. They're starting to get better at that. So good now that people are writing technical papers on how you spot the fakes. So sooner or later, I suspect they're probably going to get pretty good at it. But let's just look at the details here. How do you change a scale into a feather? Did you ever stop to think about that? You know, have you guys ever seen scaly creatures like a snake skin? Have you kids ever played with a snake skin? I don't recommend grabbing the snake and taking it off. Let them do it themselves. But those scales, they're all connected together. A feather grows different. A feather actually grows out of a follicle, like a hair. Hey, kids, you ever pull one of your hairs out? Yeah. Have you ever pulled somebody else's hair out? Yeah, that's more fun, isn't it? You see, a hair grows out of a follicle. A feather grows out of a follicle. Scales don't grow that way. How do you change a scale into a feather? You see, we see a lot of skin imprints of dinosaurs. Right there where they died and laid down, left their imprints, they were clearly scaly creatures. How do you change a scale into a feather? You see, it's simply impossible when you start looking at the details of this. But here was something that was published that was just shocking. In the secular world, I'm actually surprised they published this. This was published in the New Scientist in 2012, back in March. Now, look at these fossils. What are those? Can you guys spot those? Fossilized feathers, aren't they? Beautiful fossilized feathers. You know what the caption here is? See what they say? They look like feathers. You know what the conclusion of the paper was? They said these are not true feathers. Now, they viewed those collagen fibers as being true feathers, but those they did not view as true feathers. Here's why. These feathers were found in fossil layers essentially before the dinosaurs. So their conclusion was these can't be true feathers because dinosaurs haven't evolved into birds yet. Don't let the evidence get in the way. Now, is this a problem for the Christian? No, it's not. Birds are created on day 5. Dinosaurs are created on day 6. Having them found in flood sediment is not a big deal. Well, here's another thing that happened, even more recent than that. Oops. A theropod dinosaur found to eat birds. Now, just so you know, it's the theropod line of dinosaurs that supposedly evolved into birds. So they found this theropod, and if you look in here, you see some stomach contents right in the inside of there? They can zoom up to that, and they can actually identify those bones. It's from 3 different birds. So how is it that theropods evolved into birds when birds are already around being eaten by theropods? Those are big problems. You know, we can go into a host of issues on that, but I'll leave you to the research of Dr. David Menton and Dr. Alan Fiducia, some of those experts. But when you start looking at the details, friends, it's impossible to change dinosaurs into birds. Now, to the world's defense, not everybody out there believes dinosaurs evolved into birds. You know what the second most popular view is among the secularists? That some asteroid or comet or something came in, struck the Earth, and killed all the dinosaurs. Hey, look, there's my comet right there. Whew, almost went flying on one engine on that one. But, yeah, there's a problem with this, though. Why would it essentially kill all the dinosaurs and really nothing else? There's problems with that. I've seen some technical papers said all the dinosaurs died of disease. I've seen other technical papers said they starved to death. Believe it or not, I saw another one said they overate. And, you know, you wouldn't believe me if I told you this latest one that came out. You know what? It actually came out over here in the UK. I'm going to put the press headline up. Here it is. Dinosaurs gassed themselves into extinction, British scientists say. Yes. They say that dinosaurs gave off so much flatulence that it affected the climate, and climate change led to the demise of the dinosaurs. Now, the press was all over them on this, by the way. Well, I went to my artist, and I said, hey, can you draw this up for me? He's like, how am I supposed to draw that? And so a kid came up to me in an audience. He said, you draw it like this. Kids are brilliant, aren't they? But really, is there a mystery to why dinosaurs are dying out? Is there really a mystery? A big picture, the ultimate reason why dinosaurs are dying out is because of sin. When Adam and Eve sinned against God, God basically gave us a taste of what life was like without him. We started to see death and suffering come in and begin to reign in this world. We've seen hosts of animals go extinct, hosts of them. The ultimate reason is because of sin. Now, some of the specific reasons could be changed environment. The world before the flood and the world after the flood were tragically different. Most creationists believe there was an ice age that followed the flood, where a third of the world would have been covered with ice. How well do reptiles do in the cold? Not very well. It makes sense why their numbers may have been diminished and things like mammals thrive a little better. What about being hunted by man? Do you remember Nimrod in the Bible just a couple chapters after the flood? He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Could he have wiped out whole populations before they filled the earth? It's possible. I consider also those dragon legends. Do you realize most of the dragon legends all over the world ended with a dragon getting killed? Yeah, these things were getting hunted. We'd leave open those options like diseases or genetic problems or catastrophic events. You know, we've enacted an endangered species list, which is a good thing. Because so many animals are dying off. We've seen passenger pigeons go extinct, dodo birds. More recently, people think the West African rhino went extinct. There's whole lists of animals that are on the verge of extinction. What if we wouldn't have enacted an endangered species list? How many things would have went extinct just this past 100 years? Hosts of things. You see, friends, the ultimate reason is sin. There could be a host of reasons that are specific to different dinosaurs in particular, though. So are dinosaurs extinct completely? That's a great question. For me to say yes, I'd have to look everywhere in the entire world at the exact same time. Friends, I'm not that good. I realized when I was reading a lot of those dragon legends that dragons live near swamps, a lot of times underground. We've destroyed most of the swamp ground in the past 500 years. We're actually reintroducing it in a number of areas, especially there in the states where I'm at. We've destroyed most of it. I mean, you got a handful of big ones down in Florida and whatnot, and we do see that. But by and large, we've destroyed a lot of that environment. You know, is it possible they're living in rainforests? You just don't see them. Or living underground, only come out once in a while. I don't know. Those are good questions. I'd like to see more research on that. But until we actually find something, I do not have my hopes too high, just so you know. Well, is there any evidence that confirms that man and dinosaurs lived together besides, say, the Bible? Actually, there's quite a bit. These are called cave drawings or etchings. The fancy term for that is petroglyph. And we find these things all over the world. Let me just run you through a few of these. Here's one out at Havasupai Canyon. It's one of the side canyons off the Grand Canyon. The Havasupai Native Americans drew this creature alongside other creatures, and it looks strikingly similar to an Edmontosaurus. Here's one out at Natural Bridges National Monument, and the Anasazi Native Americans drew this one. There's other things out around it, but this creature looks strikingly similar to a sauropod type of dinosaur. Here's another one out at San Rafael Swell in Utah. Of course, this looks more like a flying reptile as opposed to, say, one of the dinosaurs. Like I said, LA Sense, we sometimes lump those in. Here's one up in Canada. Over in Canada. I got to remember where I'm at now. Over in Canada. This is actually up at Lake Superior. And you can even see a boat here in the background. But this creature, you know, a lot of dinosaurs had something like this, very similar to something like a Kentrosaurus-type dinosaur or something similar. Over here in northern England, there's Carlisle Cathedral. A man named Bishop Bell died around the year 1500. He's buried in the church and you know, right here in the floor, and you might see this brassing that goes along the outside. If you zoom up to that, there's a whole bunch of animals you would readily recognize. And then suddenly you get to some that look kind of like dinosaurs. It's fascinating to see that. Go down to Australia. The Aborigines had this painted up of a creature that they hunted. The reason they hunted it was it ate one of their kinsmen. You can kind of see them in there. But this creature looks a lot like one of those water reptiles or water dragons, like a plesiosaur or something like that. You go over to Angkor in Cambodia. There was an ancient temple that was rediscovered maybe 20 years or so, and they've been fixing it up, trying to work on it, and there's this relief that had a number of animals in it. One of them looks kind of like a stegosaur, but not quite. Yeah, I could see that being part of the stegosaur kind. The Ishtar Gate in Babylon, built by order of Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar had this, this is the eighth gate to Babylon built. It's got this creature and an extinct type of cattle, an auroch, that's on it. And look at this. It's a scaly creature. It's got a reptilian tongue. It's got a hip structure so that it raises its body up off the ground. By definition, that's a dinosaur right there. Just neat to see. John Calvin, who came out of the Reformation, wrote a commentary on the whole Bible in Latin. When Genesis was translated from Latin to English in the year 1578, I don't know if you can see that's right down here. This is the artwork that accompanied it. And if you look on here, you can see a pig's head. There's a stylized bird. There's a host of different things. But here's what caught my attention. If you zoom up, you see a couple of dragons along the top. And here's what really blew my mind. Down at the bottom middle, it's upside down, which usually signifies that it's dead. But this creature looks strikingly similar to an ornithopod type of dinosaur. Over at the Creation Museum, in our dinosaur den, we got a whole bunch of dinosaurs right up through there. A lot of people walk right past it. It's one of the smaller dinosaurs. This is an idea of what an ornithopod type of dinosaur would have looked like. Of course, you know, coloration, we sometimes have to guess on some of that. But there's one right there. Kind of gives you an idea. Some other literature, Gilgamesh killed a huge reptile-like creature whose description is very similar to that of a dinosaur in a cedar forest. One of the famous ones over in this area is Beowulf. Beowulf was famous for killing three dragons. He killed Grendel, Grendel's mother, and later in his life he killed a fiery flying serpent, which is where he sustained enough injury where he died himself. But the description of Grendel is uncannily similar to a baryonyx. Baryonyx literally means heavy claw. Now, Beowulf was famous because he ripped the whole arm off of this big dragon-like creature. It was a dragon-like creature that had a smaller arm but a big claw in there. That's what baryonyx means, literally heavy claw here. And that's what that dinosaur looks like. The description is so similar, it's hard to believe. If you flip over to science, red blood cells, they don't last very long if I were to cut myself and spill out red blood cells. Now, there were some researchers out west in the United States led by Dr. Mary Schweitzer. And they found a T-Rex femur down in a ravine, and they got that cleaned up, but they couldn't get it out of the ravine. And they're like, oh, we can't leave it there. So they got a helicopter. They brought the helicopter in, went down the ravine. So they tried to put that big T-Rex femur on it. Turns out it was too big to fit. So they did something no researchers had done before. They took that T-Rex femur and broke it in half. Took it back to the lab, zoomed up where they broke it apart, and look at this. They found some preserved red blood cells. Now, they were in shock because they're like, whoa, there is no way red blood cells could possibly last 65 million years. It's simply impossible. There's just no way. So you know what they said? Well, I guess red blood cells really do last 65 million years. So, well, since then, they've cracked open more T-Rex bones, and they found some soft tissue. Some of it was stretchy. It gave off an odor. They were able to smell it. They even found a vein. You know, I've known some creationists that cracked open a triceratops horn, and they found some soft tissue as well. They even found a vein. They zoomed up into the vein. They found crystallized material inside the vein. Now, does it make more sense that something like that's a matter of thousands of years old as opposed to, say, 65 million years old? That's what I would suggest anyway. Okay, let's review. That's a fancy way of saying you're going to have a test. Hey, kids, you guys want to have a test? No. You kids don't want to have it? Hey, I have an idea. How about we test your parents? You want to do that and see how well they did? You want to do that? Yeah, let's see how well they did. All right, what day were dinosaurs created? Day six. And what did they originally eat? Plants, vegetarian foods. That's right. Now, something happened because some of those dinosaurs did start to eat meat. What event was that? Sin in the fall. That's right. Now, were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? Yeah. What happened to the dinosaurs that weren't on Noah's Ark? That's right. They died. A lot of them probably rotted, decayed, things like that. Now, did dinosaurs come off of Noah's Ark? Yep. And they've been dying out for a host of reasons. What's the ultimate reason? Because of sin. Can you name some of the specific reasons? Hunted. Disease, yeah. Climate change, things like that. Did somebody say gas? We're not taking that one. The others are good enough. Now, as a bonus question, can anybody tell me when did we start digging up dinosaur bones in a great amount of detail? Remember what century that was? Yeah, 19th century, 1800s. That's exactly right. And they called them dinosaur bones, which means terrifying or terrible lizard. Makes you wonder, would there be a controversy if they just called them dragon bones? Makes you wonder. Well, kids, how'd they do? They do pretty good? Yes and no. Kids give out two grades, A, F. There's no curve, from the kids. It just doesn't happen. You see, we're in a culture where people have been looking at dinosaurs from two different viewpoints. You know, we took a lot of time to look at dinosaurs from a biblical viewpoint. You know what? The Bible makes sense of dinosaurs, makes sense of dragons. So I want to encourage you to trust what God has to say on that subject. Now, as a Christian, I'm assuming most people who come here are Christians. There might be people who come through who are not Christians. You know, we welcome you here. I hope you're having a great time. But we also hope you're challenged to a certain degree, especially to consider the claims of Christ. Because, friends, that's what this is all about. We want you to understand that the Bible's history is true. And so you can use dinosaurs as missionary lizards. That's right. You really can. Because you can go and share with people, hey, the Bible makes sense of dinosaurs. And that's what we do at the Creation Museum there at Answers in Genesis. We have a host of dinosaurs. We have this huge main hall, and it filters right down here to where you actually go in. We have a huge animatronic sauropod up here. It's about two-thirds size. Head moves out there. It was really neat. My daughter loved this dinosaur. She used to run right up here and just look at it. It'd move its head out there. She loved it. One day we went in after hours when the lights were off, and she ran up to this dinosaur, and they turned it off so it wasn't moving. She's like, oh, Daddy, shh. And I'm like, what's going on? She's like, be quiet. The dinosaur is sleeping. Cute when they're 3 years old. Now she's eight. But we have a dinosaur dig site just trying to point out, hey, we all are looking at the same dinosaurs. We're all looking at the same evidence. We have the dinosaur den where you see hosts of different dinosaurs. Dragon Hall Bookstore, we have an animatronic flying reptile here. We got some baby T-Rexes that are animatronic. It is a fascinating place. But one of the things we're trying to point to people is, hey, the Bible makes sense of history. It makes sense of things like dinosaurs. And because the Bible's history is true, guess what? The message of salvation founded in that same history is also true. That's what we want people to understand. That's why we do what we do. So what kind of resources can you get your hands on that look at dinosaurs from, say, a biblical viewpoint? Obviously, you can always hop on our website. We even have a kids' website, by the way. If you hop on here and hit /kids, you can go there. There's a lot of videos, things on dinosaurs and different animals. And, you know, it's a great place. Kids, if you go there, ask your parents' permission to be able to get on there. But we have a whole section on dinosaurs on our website. Again, you can sign up for our newsletter. It's free. At the Ark Encounter, we are going to have dinosaurs there. It's going to be pretty neat to see how they fit on board Noah's Ark. You know, we've been doing massive studies on the dinosaur kinds and things like that. Not just dinosaur kinds, but all the animal kinds that need to be on board. If you haven't got the magazine, I want to encourage you to sign up for that. It's a great deal. One of my favorite books on dinosaurs, which we I don't think we have this out there, is The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved. You can always order that through the website if you really wanted to get that. It's an older book, but it's still one of my favorites on the subject. If you like this talk, we've actually got it recorded. It's called Dragons, Dinosaurs, and the Bible. We got a number of copies out here if you're interested in that one. Another great DVD on the subject of dinosaurs is Jurassic Prank. It's by Dr. Tommy Mitchell. He's from Tennessee, so you might have to translate that English into British English before you fully understand it. But excellent DVD, by the way. I've got a book, Dragons, Legends, and Lore Dinosaurs. It looks at some of those petroglyphs, some of the different legends. Where is the word dragon found in some of these old translations of the Bible? It is fascinating when we look at this. The artwork in here is brilliant. We also have a book called Dinosaurs for Kids. I would say this is from, say, ages 7 years old on up. Even we adults like this. It goes through the seven Fs of dinosaurs. Formed, fearless, fallen, flood. You see, everything starts with the same letter, I'm telling you. For the littler kids, we have the D is for Dinosaurs, one of the flip books, a wonderful book. We've got a deal on the A is for Adam, D is for Dinosaur, and N is for Noah, where you can get three of them for the price of two. I think you can get all three for £20. Is that right? That's right. I got the thumbs up. One of these answers books for kids answers a number of the questions that kids have on dinosaurs. We also have a kid's DVD. I would say anywhere from ages about 3 to 9 years old. I love this. It's a two-part DVD with Ken Ham and Buddy Davis filmed in front of kids, so kids love this type of stuff. In the Answers books, we have a number of chapters on dinosaurs. First one is Dinosaurs from a Biblical Viewpoint. Dr. David Minton wrote a chapter on here, Did Dinosaurs Evolve into Birds? I also did one on Why Don't We Find Humans and Dinosaurs Buried Together? Did you ever stop to think about that one? I mean, if there was a global flood today, what are the odds you and a lion are going to get buried together? Oh, there's a lion. I want to get buried. Sure, you have something else on your mind, right? But do you realize we don't find a whole lot of dinosaur fossils? You know, we've only found about 30 or so T-Rexes all total. The odds of a human being buried with some of these things are actually outrageous. But we actually look at the number of the factors in there. With the fourth volume, I did a chapter on dragons. It looks as, hey, when did people start thinking dragons were a myth? What about those flags? And what about the different accounts of dragons in the Bible? It really is pretty fascinating. So I want to encourage you to take a look at that one. The Answers DVDs, you know, we talk about a host of subjects related to the subject of dinosaurs, age of the earth, things like that. Answers Books for Teens also has a chapter in there on dragons and dinosaurs. But there's just a host of different resources. Now, if I can shift gears just a little bit, I want to tell you about a handful of resources. Actually, I've only got one under here. This is a brand new DVD I did called Is the Bible True? How Do We Know? Now, the reason I saved this for the end is I didn't want people just to go out there and buy this DVD as their first one, because this one actually gets pretty philosophical. It's pretty deep. I would not suggest this be your first DVD. I'd suggest some of the others. But if you guys really want to step up, what I do with this, I actually answer the question, how we know the Bible's true. Now, a lot of Christians have thrown out answers that sometimes aren't the best answers. And so I actually go through some of the other answers people have given that may not be the best answers, and then I hit with the ultimate reason why the Bible's true. So I want to encourage you to take advantage of that one while you're here. And, of course, I still wanted to recommend the Tower of Babel book and the DVD if you guys really want to get into that. This is a powerful study. I love to study the subject of people groups. Genesis chapter 10, it gives a listing of Noah's sons, grandsons, and great-grandsons. And believe it or not, we can actually trace a lot of the people groups around the world right back to one of those sons or grandsons, or sometimes they mix. You get several of these. And, you know, I spent some time talking about the English and the Germanic peoples and things like that going back because, you know, I got a lot of ancestry in that one as well. So I think you guys would thoroughly enjoy that book. But not only do I look at the Tower of Babel and languages and things like that, I love to study those people groups. I want to encourage you to take a look at those. If you want a short treatise on it, of course, the DVD, the book, you know, it's got a lot of the maps and stuff. So I want to encourage you to take a look at that. Just to give you an idea, I grew up in Western Illinois in the middle of nowhere, out in the middle of nowhere. And me and my family, we've done some genetic, or not genetic studies, but we've done genealogical studies. And one of my direct ancestors goes back to William the Conqueror, which is pretty fascinating. And if you take his lineage back, you go back to Rollo. His first wife, that's the lineage that William the Conqueror came out of. Now, when Rollo's first wife died, he married another lady, the daughter of the King of France. Now, her lineage goes all the way back to Adam. So here I am, a kid from the middle of nowhere, who I can take my lineage all the way back, jump over one, and take it all the way back to Adam. I suggest if you guys jumped in and did some of your studies, you'd be surprised how far back you could go as well. So I want to encourage you to study that. It really is a neat and fascinating subject. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to close in prayer. And did we have any announcements or anything that needed to be stated afterwards? Or nope? All right, well, I'll pray and we can be dismissed. And I really appreciate you guys coming out and supporting us this evening. So, dear Heavenly Father, we just praise your name. Thank you for giving us your word, to give us a guidebook to look at subjects like dinosaurs and dragons. And Lord, we can never say thank you enough for giving us your revealed word. Lord, help us be able to stand on that word when we preach the gospel in today's day and age. Lord, help us be able to answer those tough questions that people may present with us. And help us do it with gentleness and respect. Because, you know, it's not about arguing or debate. It's about the gospel. And help us have a heart for that. Lord, I just want to pray for a blessing for this church and for the people in this area. Lord, I pray that you guide them and bless them and strengthen them. Strengthen them to stand on your word in a culture that is increasingly hostile toward you. Lord, you know, we think back to the apostles and everything that they had to endure. You know, by and large in the Americas and, you know, over here in places like Europe, you know, we've had it very easy as Christians for a long time. And now things are getting tougher, but help us step up. Help us do the things that you want us to do to promote the gospel, promote the authority of the Bible. Lord, we thank you, we praise you, and hope that you receive the honor and the glory in all this. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, guys.